Welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Varsha, and today I'll be interviewing Caitlin Bailey, who is a stand-up comic, and she started her own podcast a while ago called The Oldest Profession Podcast, and now she's also the director, the communications director at Decriminalized Sex Work. And today we're just going to talk about her podcast, her work in understanding sex work and the history of sex work, and her current activism in it. So Caitlin, how are you doing? Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I feel great. Today was a beautiful day in New York. So,
oh, you're so lucky. Today was also a gorgeous day in Berkeley. Literally, we had 3 weeks of nonstop rain, like the rain that they advertised in the first Princess Diaries movie in San Francisco. Yeah. And you're just like, oh, this is why you moved to San Francisco, because of all this rain. And the thing is, at the end of week three, I was sick of the rain.
Yeah.
I'm not a sunny person. I moved from LA to the Bay Area for the gloom.
LA,
but this was even too much.
I mean, LA is too much for everyone. It's too much everything for everyone.
I know.
It's too much sun.
It is. It truly, truly is. Yeah. Too much sun. Too much. Yeah. It's basically. Yeah. It's too much. But
and can we just take a moment? Yeah. I mean, like, I know that you're an old hat at this, but like, this is the first time I'm using this technology.
Yeah.
Can we just take a moment to marvel at the technological capability of two feminists being able to connect from opposite coasts? Like, they've been trying to divide us for so long.
Yeah, for people who are listening, initially when I reached out to Caitlin, she was like, wait, do you have to meet me in New York? And I was like, no, I'm in California. I sadly cannot visit New York. I would love to. I haven't been to New York in months.
Like, you're such a buddy-duddy. I'm like, I have my microphone that I can bring to you.
No, but this is the coolest technology, because I've gotten to interview – have you read Rebecca Traister's work?
Yes, I love her.
I don't know if you listen to Hellbent, but I got to interview her for her recent book, Good and Mad, and it was the most transcendent interview ever. And it was because of technology that I even got the 20 minutes I did with her. It was amazing.
Oh, that is incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, okay, so back to your podcast, The Oldest Profession Podcast. So just starting from the beginning, why did you start this podcast? And what is The Oldest Profession, in case people don't know?
Well, obviously it's hunting, but that's not what the podcast is about. The podcast is about sex work. And honestly, mm-hmm. I'm a stand-up comic. You know, I've been in the entertainment industry for almost a decade now. And I was pitching this show called Whore History, where it was kind of like drunk history meets, I forget what the initial pitch was, but it would basically be me trying to tell funny stories about all of the old pros that came before me. I've been out as a sex worker since 2014. And I think mm-hmm. that it's so important, in the words of Maya Angelou, to know your history. And this is a history that has been erased over and over and over again for literally thousands of years. And I, you know, thought that presenting it in sort of like a fun, funny way would be a way to combat some of the pervasive myths around what it means to have bought or sold sex. So I was pitching the show in LA, which, as we covered in the beginning, is just too much. And the way that this show was getting interpreted by the people that were interested in buying it was, I know, instead of you telling stories about sex workers from history, we'll call you comedy ho. And then you can like just be a ho and also funny. And I'm like, I feel like I'm not being heard.
That's sort of gross. I mean, like, I'm all for owning your bonus.
Yeah, no, for sure.
But it feels like what you were pitching was like a real, like, I'm a history grad student from Berkeley, as listeners may know. And so basically when you said knowing your history, like that touches my heart, because the first thing you learn in grad school for history, first thing you learn in undergrad is everything has a history. But the second most important thing you hear is that people who write history are not telling every single story, right? And so when I reached out to you, the first thing I did was like listen to the whole show from start to finish, and like it started off, it's such a great show, and it starts off Yeah. And it starts off as like a real actual like history of like understanding these women and telling their stories. And it's so important to do that with like any kind of story, right? Like all, like I would say basically every story needs to be heard. And for the past, you know, 250 yeah. years of American history, we've been telling sort of the same story of American history. You know, here was a couple of white dudes. They decided to enslave a bunch of other people. And then they oppressed women for centuries and blah, 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 blah. They fought wars. They created.
I mean, it's so funny. That's not the way they were telling that story, but that is the story.
Yeah. And I, my advisor who might or probably doesn't listen to this will be like, Farsha, that's a reductive history. But I don't care because women and especially sex work has been given mm-hmm. a reductive history by a lot of people. And so how did you bring in comedy into the initial shows or even into now?
Well, that's the thing about being a comic is that it just goes everywhere that you go. So, yeah. You know, I am a stand-up comic. I've been, you know, hitting stages all over the country for almost a decade. And that's a craft, right? So, but I guess it's a little bit different than other crafts. Like if you make shoes, you don't have to make shoes when you're like making tables, mm-hmm. you could choose not to do that. But it's not like that with comedy. It just travels with you.
Yeah.
So I started off working with, a girlfriend of mine, also a very funny, talented and, open sex worker, Wendy Starling. I pitched the show to her from LA, after giving up out there. I did several meetings. They all went very poorly because the folks that I was talking to just could not get past the titillation, the potential titillation of sex work to see the depth of like the history and the human stories and the storytelling potential that I could see. It was sort of like this big red paint bucket that like was being poured over these otherwise still incredible stories that just sort of happen to include sex work.
Yeah. And also it's a labor story, right? It's not just a story of like women. It's not just a story of people who identify as women or people who are men or whatever.
Men,
it's also fundamentally a labor story. And teaching it or talking about it as a labor history is something that is not often considered, especially in the current politics. And so I was just wondering, my next question was like, has the podcast changed from what it started as and what it is now? Like, do you have a different goal or?
I mean, like you tell me, like, so you have the experience of having binge listened to this. I will tell you from my perspective, it started off as this comedy podcast where I would tell Wendy stories that I found interesting from sex work history. And then we would make ha-has about them. And then in April 11th of 2018, this terrible law, SESTA FOSTA, got signed into law, and that eradicated all of the online ecosystems that sex workers, many of my friends, had built for themselves to keep each other safe. And it took away this network of people that I had been hanging out with as just like a professional mouthy whore. Their livelihood sort of disappeared overnight, and all of a sudden things became very scary. And so you can kind of hear on the podcast that I get radicalized over the course of-
Yeah, I hear that. It literally, it happens within an episode, like in like one, like from April, from before April to like after April, I can see, I can hear it, right? And it also like, I think like when you talked about their livelihoods being erased, the livelihood of sex workers being erased, I'm thinking of like every other historical example of this, of when politicians or legislation in general that tries to fix, quote unquote, fix a social issue or solve a social problem. Like I go, I'm teaching my students about the progressive era, and my students are all excited about, you know, the trust busting and, you know, the messing up the monopolies and trying to pass progressive legislation. And then I tell them about the anti-divorce movement.
It's also when abortion and alcohol
When alcoholism is criminalized. But there's also a complicated story with prohibition where, like, initially women lead that movement to stop their husbands from beating them. But then it turns into this really conservative movement. And it's the same thing with divorce. There was an anti-divorce movement. And then also Jim Crow is within the progressive movement, right? Like segregation is a part and parcel of it, right? And
it's very much a product of this sort of moralizing era, right? Yeah. And if you look at the progressive era and specifically the criminalization of prostitution and the framing of white slavery, it's very much about like this idea of white women's chastity needing to be protected at all costs is weaponized in this way to target minority communities. And in fact, the Mann Act, which is one of the first federal anti-prostitution laws passed in this country, it's never really effectively been used to like stop human trafficking, for example, but it was very effectively used to criminalize interracial couples for decades.
Of course. You know, America... Yeah. We're not reliable for a lot, but we are reliable for the racism. You know, you can always
for sure.
Yeah.
The way that I frame the Sesta Fosta law, which really I think harkens back to everything that was wrong with the progressive movement, is it combines the conservative Republican like fetish for punishing women for having sex or doing things with their body. With the instinct of like liberal progressive Democrats to quote unquote help a population of people that they can't be bothered to understand. And that I think really characterizes the prohibition movement of like, it starts off with all of these women who have like really legitimate claims about how their drunk husbands are like beating them and taking their food money and they don't have any agency in this sexist marriage and like, you know, and then is co-opted and morphed by and actually ends up creating the police state that we're still fighting today.
Yeah, definitely. And like, so that leads into like my next question, which is like, what's something that you've learned from doing the podcast, maybe about yourself or about sex work in general? Like what's like a few things or maybe the one thing that you think you've learned that was the most important?
I think the thing that has struck me across the couple of years that I've been doing this is that we've been trying to tell our stories the whole time. You can't find a moment in history where sex workers did not eloquently articulate the truth about their lives. And that those voices have been drowned out or either silenced violently, which happens over and over again, or just erased and ignored. So I kind of bought into the big patriarchal myth that like women just hadn't been talking this whole time, you know, like, oh, they were so busy, what with the house and kids. There were a few standout examples. You know, I knew about Veronica Franco before I started the podcast, who is one of the first published poets in the Western canon. And she is a great, courtesan who is brought down and humbled, in her time by sort of the jealous poets around her that use her as a scapegoat and, try her for witchcraft, it doesn't, we listen to the podcast, but yeah. I knew about Veronica Franco, but I sort of thought, and Gypsy Rose Lee and all of these other figures, but I sort of thought that they were like standout bitches, you know? I didn't realize that we had all been telling our story the whole time. And I think that the inverse of what you said before, and that like all stories ought to be told, is that we should all be telling our stories. And I think that one of the most impactful, effective things that you can do, if you can, as a sex worker or as any member of a marginalized community, is to come out proudly.
Yeah. And it can be hard, but it's so important to like initially find that support system to do so and then do you know? I mean, I listened to one of your recent episode has call-ins, right? Where you, other people read the stories of sex workers who may not feel comfortable telling their own stories in their own voice. And it's so like heartbreaking, but also like fulfilling. Like there was that one story of that person who told her mom, and her mom was just curious. Like, like her mom just like didn't, I don't think her mom judged her. Her mom just like kept asking questions, and it was fascinating. Yeah. And there were other stories that were more heartbreaking. You know, the story of a person who lost her job because of it. And so I was wondering, like, what do you hope other people like learn from it? Is it the core idea of telling your own story, or what do you hope people who listen to the podcast learn?
I think that it's important to understand that, like, on a generational level, we are not alone. Mm-hmm. Right. I think that like one of the big perverse lies that we told the LGBT community, that we told the polyamorous community, and that we certainly told the sex work community is that you are an aberration. What you're doing mm-hmm. is so deviant, such a departure from what normal people have always done, that you should be so filled with shame that you cannot speak. And the truth is that the whole world has always been made up of all kinds of people doing all kinds of things for all kinds of reasons, having all kinds of feelings about it.
Yeah, I think that's definitely something that I learned from this podcast. It's like, it's so pervasive how not just society, but like individuals on a daily basis hear this message, is that you are not mm-hmm. just not normal, but like so far from the normal based on your identity, right? Like, I don't just mean me liking to wear like blue eyeshadow is an aberration. Like that itself is okay. But like, it's more like the way that identities across the spectrum have been criticized and demonized over history is just so frustrating. And it's so important to hear it from like a single perspective in a single place, right? There's so many other podcasts that tell the story of like racial history, you know, history of sexism, the history of so many other things, the history of gay rights. And so this takes like a small piece of that and really like brings it to life. And so I was just wondering, you know, my final thoughts are like, what are your final thoughts on like how is sex work being talked about in politics right now? And like, what's the most like, so you talk about Sesta Fosta and like how much damage did that do? Like, not just to the practical aspect of sex work, but like how people are talking about it.
Yeah, no, we are right now. I think that we are living in a sex panic. I think that, you know, if you just replace the phrase sex trafficking with white slavery, we could be reliving the 19 teens. And I think that we are erecting, I think that in many ways, the federal government is understanding that they're starting to lose the drug war. I think that we're going to start to see a relaxing of drug laws. You know, I think marijuana is the start of that. Mm-hmm. But I really do think that we are using the infrastructure that was built to combat a war on drugs and replacing it with a war on whores, which is morphing into a war on sexual minorities. And so like one of the scariest things for me, I also think that we're sort of shifting power and that like moving from sort of government control to more corporate control. And I think that Sesta Fosta is one of the first examples of that. And that sure, the federal government, what passed the Sesta Fosta law, but what it essentially did was incentivized private companies to reduce their liability by censoring content, which the government can't do because that would be a violation of First Amendment principles, right? So I think that seeing this shift right now, the Marriott hotels, United Airlines are investing millions and millions of dollars in training their deeply exploited labor force into being able to spot quote unquote sex trafficking, which if you read the training manuals, they make no distinction between consensual adult sex work and like actual violent trafficking situations. And they completely gloss over all of the ways that people are labor trafficked because they might be afraid that it applies to their staff. So it's really interesting to see, like, for example, there's a restaurant on the Upper East Side that no longer allows women to eat alone at the bar to crack down on sex trafficking. There's a law right now being pushed through the Florida State Senate that would mandate all lodging houses, all hotels, all motels must train their employees on how to spot human trafficking. But of course, we're not talking about labor trafficking. We're only talking about sex work. And so we're passing laws based on this myth that is using this infrastructure, the, you know, the prison industrial complex, the police state, the surveillance state, to really crack down on women's sexual autonomy, specifically. And so I fear a future where it's harder for women to travel alone. It's harder for women to speak their mind for fear of being called not necessarily a dirty whore, but a sex trafficking victim that has to be re-educated in this detention center. So that, I think, is the shift that we're seeing. And I mean, of course, this impacts minority communities. But it's, I mean, even with the arrest of Robert Kraft, like this isn't just a feminist issue. So I'm working for an organization right now called Decriminalize Sex Work. And the way that I frame it is, our fundraiser and one of our main political strategists is a libertarian, and out as a client. Our general counsel is a progressive Democrat and has dedicated her life. She went to law school to decriminalize sex work. We have an anti-human trafficking expert who has been a social worker combating human trafficking her entire career. She's an anarchist, and I'm a comic. So, and I know from studying sex work that we're all over the political spectrum, but with the arrest of Robert Kraft in the, when the police targeted the sex trafficking ring, that wasn't like that case completely fell apart. There are no trafficking charges being held against those women. They're just sitting in jail facing prostitution charges if they haven't already been deported. But this impacts powerful men as well. Like the nobody is safe when we crack down on sex workers. This touches everyone. Everyone has a bone in this fight. So I'm calling on all kinds of people. I don't care how you identify or what your political spectrum is, to stand against the state caging people for any kind of adult consensual sex, whether it is paid or not.
That's a really amazing like mission. And it's such like a good like way to really like push back against any criticism you could already see ahead of time is like, oh no, don't worry. We have a conservative on our staff. We also have,
yes, we definitely do.
We also have someone who's an expert in actual human trafficking to help you differentiate between consensual and non-consensual sex. Right. And I feel like that was sort of my next question in terms of the politics is like when I read about, the Kraft arrest, I wasn't actually sure whether or not he was arrested for, consensual paid sex or non-consensual like paid sex. Like,
well, first of all, he wasn't arrested. There's no sex happening in that salon. We're talking about hand jobs and occasionally blow jobs.
Okay.
This is a rub and tug place.
Got it.
That's what's happening. And that, like, there are no women under the age of 30. So these are definitely adult women, many of whom have been working at the establishment for years, many of whom had other residences like in Florida. So they were Florida residences, Like there's just no evidence of trafficking whatsoever, but he was arrested for, soliciting sex work. But what I find so interesting about this case is that like Robert Kraft didn't bully like his personal masseur into doing a sex act against their will. He went to an establishment well known for providing this service and paid what was asked of him for this service that was provided.
Yeah.
To try to reframe that as some kind of violent sex act, I think is to willfully misunderstand rape. And I think that's like, it's one of the pieces of the rape culture that we live in. Like, because we, you know, we have this, we're having this this moment right now where we're like, believe women. And I'm like, believe women when they tell you they said yes, in addition to believing women when they said no. In the same county that Robert Kraft was heroically arrested for paying for this sex service, there are currently 5,000 unsolved reported rapes in that county. Stop framing men that pay for sex as being as violent as the men that think they can just take it. Those are the real criminals.
No, I think that's what made me so uncomfortable about this whole thing was the way people were poking jokes at it is because I've seen these jokes throughout like the past, I don't know, since I knew what sex was, you see these jokes online of like, oh, yes, like if you pay for it, you are like less than or something, or you are doing something inherently creepy. And the reason I was frustrated with that is not because mm-hmm. I had a formed opinion on these men or people in general who are paying for it or paying for sex. It's more that right? I was like, you're taking the autonomy away from the person who wants the money for yes. it, right? It's like, it's fundamentally a labor issue. I feel like the reason that I am so like, and I don't want to say clear-headed because I don't know everything about this. It's yes. more that it's so simple to me is that it's a labor issue. If we have autonomy yes. over our bodies when it comes to whether or not I want to terminate a pregnancy, and I have autonomy whether or not I want to have consensual mm-hmm. sex with a boyfriend or someone I have a date with, then I should have autonomy over my body if I want to exchange that for something else. Mm-hmm. Because when I'm going out, like if I decide to go out and work as a mover, or I'm working on like,
right.
or I'm in the early 20th century and I'm building a fucking railroad, I have autonomy over my labor sure. then. And obviously you don't have complete autonomy because there is exploited labor. But what's frustrating about Sesta Fosta is that it totally eliminates any safety net for people to take away the idea that maybe my labor won't be exploited, right? I feel like that's what's so difficult about that's what's so important about decriminalizing sex work, is that the fundamental thing you're doing is making sure that the labor itself isn't exploited, not only giving autonomy back to women.
I wanted to make this point earlier, like something that our human trafficking expert has drilled into my head is that, you know, because criminalizing sex work hurts victims of trafficking.
Yeah.
So because it prevents them from being able to report crimes committed against them by their traffickers, by clients, often by the police, right? There was that the guy that the Ohio vice cop that shot Donna Dalton, who was a single mother and a sex worker in Ohio 8 times, was just arrested by the FBI for kidnapping and raping multiple women. So, sorry, that I'm conflating two issues, but I want to push back against this labor rights issue, because I think that it is a labor rights issue for sure, but we can't. But it is mm-hmm. also a sexual yeah. autonomy issue, because we've seen over and over again, every place that tries to police sex work ends up policing people that are not in the sex trade, making it impossible for women to move freely in society. This is one of the big consequences of the Contagious Diseases Acts in England in the 1860s, and our version of that, which was the American plan during World War I, where we empowered local police forces mm-hmm. around military bases, specifically Navy bases, to pick up any quote unquote loose looking woman to check her for STDs. Of course, this is before STD tests were accurate. So it's basically just like a doctor looking at your pussy, deciding whether or not mm-hmm. you look slutty, and then quarantining you until it was framed as this, God. As this public health thing. Right. But they weren't testing enlisted men. Right. And I don't know if you've ever been in the army or like I'm an army brat. Right. So like I understand that my father was like not a free man. Like okay. The army could do whatever they wanted to him up and until sending him into battle to die. Right. So they refused to do any testing on their enlisted men and instead empowered the police to police quote unquote prostitutes, but it ends up like just regular women, mostly poor women, are being picked up by the police and disappeared mm-hmm. into these lock hospitals. I mean, it really can get cray.
Yeah. And I think what's like very Handmaid's Tale about it is that the way that our non-illustrious president talks about, like, for example, like this idea that Mexican Americans or Latino Americans are coming up from the border and like raping women.
Yes.
There's two directions where autonomy is being taken away from women, right? This idea that we cannot protect ourselves and that we like the white chaste women must be protected by like this savage man or whatever, which basically enlists the state to be even harsher against only certain types of men, specifically men of color. And then also that instead of policing at least in history, instead of like policing people who are like men who are hurting women, you are policing the most marginalized people, specifically the women who are seeking their own autonomy. And so like that, this is like a long-winded way of saying that Sesta Fosta fucking sucks ass, right?
Yeah, no, Sesta Fosta fucking sucks. And it in addition to some things that were happening in my personal life, were radicalized me.
Yeah.
Like I was, I was within the comedy community, which is like an notoriously misogynistic space. But I think like our one shared principle is that you can talk about anything, right? That we are all storytellers who are living our lives out loud, telling our story. But when a much more famous comedian violated me sexually, it suddenly became impossible for me to tell that story within this community. So I felt like very aggressively silenced and actually like sort of hit with the threat of a defamation lawsuit and like lots of other gnarly things happened. And so that I channeled that rage and that sort of like righteousness, which is, I would argue, the antithesis of comedy. It's very difficult to do comedy from a righteous place. It's much easier to do comedy from a nihilist place. Is to try to change the stories that we tell about what it means to do or be a sex worker, to try to have some kind of impact on the way that we police women's bodies.
I'm so sorry that happened to you. And it's so amazing that you were able to re-channel your rage, right? Like we were talking about Rebecca Traister earlier, and I feel like this morning I was feeling like particularly angry, and it didn't have to do with sex work. It had to do with, I saw a tweet about basically Senator Harris, Gillibrand, and Warren all say that they want to maybe expand the Supreme Court, basically pack the court to basically fix the fucked up Supreme Court that we have. And I was like, fuck yeah. But, and instead of just being excited, I also like remember that for the past almost 3 weeks, everyone has been talking about the men who are running. And I was furious that then I like released like a thread onto Twitter, just being like, just vote for the fucking woman. Like, what are you doing? Right. And I like, it's so great that you were able to like channel that rage. And you said that it's hard to do comedy.
I also picked up Muay Thai. So hitting things hard always helps.
Yeah. That's true. I need to start kickboxing. I have a friend who does it.
Yeah, for sure.
And I have a couple of friends who do it, and they like apparently love it.
It really is. It, that and ACA are like my new religion. It's so important. Like my body has changed, and it changes the way that I move in the world. Like I'm still just as vulnerable, like actually, right? But it really has shifted the way that I move through the world for the better. Just the last 2 years of like of heavy bag punching and weightlifting and like feeling like more secure in my core.
Yeah. Wow. And that's so like, I don't want to like push the metaphor too hard, but that's so like true of like how sex workers want to move through the world. They just want to like find a way to move through the world safely. And they find ways to do that. That's amazing. Yeah. And I think so my last.
I wanted to say that I think that is something that's also very interesting and in that we have so aggressively shamed like Eros energy or like sexual energy in women that to be a whore is this net negative. But I don't think that framing is inevitable. I think that was something that was aggressively done to us. I think if you look back at the history of sex work, that we are very much sort of channeling this ancient, undeniable, powerful force and kind of like a magic trick, making money like from nothing through the channeling of this thing that civilian women are very aggressively shamed for. I mean, the anti-slut shaming movement is what, like a decade old? Like we have been telling women to button up, hide away, cover their faces, cover their cunts, like for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And sex workers, I think their real crime has been rejecting that patriarchal trope of rejecting the idea that their fathers, their husbands, or the men in their society get to control their sexuality. It is for them and for their profit.
Yeah. So like my sort of one of my final questions was, so you said you work at, you know, you're the communications director for Decriminalize Work. And I was wondering, like, what do you think the challenges are to decriminalizing sex work?
We face the conservative, you know, Christian coalition, like those that do not believe that women should be free to make sexual choices, right? And also the carceral feminists that just refuse to acknowledge that just because they can't imagine making this choice, that other people might, and that punitive measures are the best way to control other people's behavior, and that controlling other people's behavior is something that we ought to be investing lots of energy and resources in. So I think, and that is an old alliance, right? We saw that alliance with the porn wars and the censoring effort there. We saw that alliance during the progressive era, which I'm sure you're very familiar with. And we've seen it before. So I think that those are our two big enemies. And of course, you know, like the police state just wants to like feed itself, and it feeds on the bodies of criminalized people. So like there are lots and lots of systems in place where the go along to get along is continuing to criminalize and cage people for making, for engaging in the oldest profession.
This is a tough question to ask, but what is like the perfect, not society, but like example of what it looks like when we do decriminalize sex work, right? Like what works and what is helped, you know?
So I think it was not Simone de Beauvoir. I'm trying to remember maybe you can help me with this. The feminist who said, we don't want special treatment. We simply want you to remove your boot from our neck.
Oh, wait, I do know who this is. One second. Oh no, it's not Sarah Grimke. It's, no, it's Ruth Bader Ginsburg. What am I saying? It's RBG. All I ask of our brethren is that they take their feet off our necks.
Yes, is that they take our feet off our necks. And I think that that has to be the first step, mm-hmm. right? So what I want in my lifetime, the goal that I'm fighting for is to just stop the arrests.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if we can stop sicking the police on this vulnerable population of people, I believe that self-governing like systems will emerge from those people no longer fearing persecution, right? So whether that looks like labor organizing, or whether that looks like, you know, brothel co-ops, or whether it looks like a bunch of people working independently, I don't know what the future looks like, but I think that if we can just stop the arrests while avoiding the temptation to apply onerous regulations, cut the majority of people out of the market, right? We don't want to recreate the Nevada system, right? We don't want like six rich dudes owning a monopoly on the only licensed brothels, right? That's a dystopian yeah. nightmare nobody wants. But if we can just stop the arrests, then I think that we can build a brighter future for everyone. Now, if I had my druthers and I, you know, we're maybe not queen for a day, but like goddess for a day, I think it really does look like the female deity worship, from a really long time ago when we all worshiped, a female god before the lie that women were made from man's rib to serve him. When we all looked around at the obvious truth that we are all born of woman, right? Where paying for for sexual connection and to access that ancient Eros energy was an act of worship and not an act of defilement or conquering. So I think that's the ideal future. Now, that history obviously comes with lots of complications. We were, you know, castrating dudes left and right. So like maybe we could skip that part. but you know, the Ishtar goddess in the North America, Tlazolteotl, like every continent, every people has its like sort of ancient whore deity, Aphrodite more recently, you know, like, so this isn't such a foreign concept, but this idea that when, you know, from a heteronormative perspective, when a man and a woman come together, that it is the man who takes something from the woman.
Yeah.
I think is like, is the big lie. That's not how sex works. Yeah. Like, it's men that leave their life force behind. They're useless after sex. They can't even make their own sandwiches.
Yeah. I mean, I think what, like, if I was also, like, queen for a day, like, what I would envision decriminalizing sex work ends up doing is plays a big role in helping men and women understand, like, what actual equality and, like, feminism looks like, especially in this one aspect of our lives that everyone goes through. Like, almost every single person, right, goes through this period in their life where they're exploring and understanding their sexuality. And when you live in a society that doesn't criminalize a huge portion of it, you're able to fully understand, like, not only your own sexuality, but the people around you.
Yeah. Sex workers have been slithering their way into male spaces that other women were excluded from literally the whole time, right? So like courtesans were the only women in medieval Venice that were legally allowed into the libraries, right? I think sex workers are some of the first feminists. Sex workers have a lot to contribute to the Me Too movement, but not if you call the sex we consent to rape. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that freeing up sex workers from this persecution allows us to contribute big picture ideas to the conversation that help make things better for everyone. I think sex workers have in many ways been like the carrier of some of this like sacred knowledge about like sex and connection and humanity that is lost when we fear for our lives. Not that fear for our lives has prevented us from desperately trying to tell our stories the whole time.
Yeah. So sort of more lighthearted, but also not so lighthearted question is what's like the most frustrating representation of sex work in the media or in movies or in culture? Like what comes to mind for me is Pretty Woman. I remember watching that in like college and being like, this grosses me out. Like I fucking hate Richard Gere. Like I hate this guy.
I love Richard Gere. I just thought Julia Roberts was like a bad whore.
Okay. Can you explain why? Because I can't verbalize it. Why exactly is she a bad whore in that movie?
Sure. So like the scene where she's like, she's doing her thing and they're in the hotel room and she's like trying, like read a room. Like she's doing a bad job, like responding to his like pretty obvious clues. Yeah. And then the other stuff, it's like, you're trying to make me believe that a sex worker doesn't know how to go clothes shopping. Like that's the leap we're going to make. Like she needs his help picking out dresses. Like, fuck you and your dumb classic bullshit.
That's so true. Cause I've been thinking exactly what you said for the past 5 years since I've seen this movie.
Wait, you only saw it 5 years ago? How old are you?
I'm 24.
Okay. All right. Okay. That makes marginally more sense.
What's that movie is it Dylan McDermott or Dermot Mahoney is a male escort to a wedding and it's Deborah Messing?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I remember that. I remember being frustrated at the premise of that film.
Yeah. One second. Like the movie was like, it was, oh yeah, it's called The Wedding Date, where basically Deborah Messing brings a guy. I confuse the two all the time, which one it is. Like I forget who is who. Yeah. Dermot Mulroney to the wedding. Like she hires him. He's an escort. And like, she's super, like basically she's a prude and she sleeps with him. And then, like, she belittles him, like, or, like, the point of the movie is that he feels really insulted when she tries to pay him. And I was like, that makes no sense. If you're a professional sex worker, you want to get paid. You don't fall in love with your client, like, 2 minutes after meeting them and go, I do not want to get paid. I don't think, like, that's how that works. So I feel like that's what, like, one aspect of all of this that really frustrates me is that we don't have an actual like vocabulary in public.
One of my favorite sex worker characters that I think doesn't get enough credit is actually there are two. Mm-hmm. One, the sex worker in Trading Spaces, right? who is both the cause of the one of the main characters' downfall and also the person that gets him back up on his feet, right? Which I think is like a beautiful sort of like cyclical encapsulation of sex workers and their role. And also the idiocracy. They took a quote unquote most average man and a quote unquote most average woman who is now a very famous comedic actress whose name I'm never going to be able to remember. And the woman, the most average woman that like time travels into the future is a sex worker. There's another sort of like piece of like, you know, they can try to erase us, but like they really can't because we're literally everywhere and we're very loud. We're the mouthiest of women historically. One of the oldest Western myths. Right. So the Epic of Gilgamesh, the one of the warriors comes back, and in order to re-enter society, he has to spend 7 days and seven nights with one of the descendants of Ishtar, who is like a priestess prostitute. And so she provides this literal lubricant between the theater of war and re-entering society, which I think is a role, like sex workers and soldiers go together like before peanut butter and jelly was a thing. And I think that there really is something to that of the re-acclimating yourself to the rhythms of society from the battlefield is like the body of the woman and the civilizing force of sensual touch and reconnecting to that.
Those are some good examples of understanding sex work in our pop culture, even though Epic of Gilgamesh is thousands of years old.
It's a profession. I mean, obviously hunting actually is, but this is also very old. This also predates us as a species.
Yeah. Well, okay. So, thank you so much for answering all these questions. I feel so much like, I feel like I know so much more now. But also, yeah, it was like your podcast is just so great. You should just keep doing it. And it's so great to hear that you guys, you all have started a new organization to decriminalize this sex work. And so we usually end the show by asking our guests, like, what are you grateful for this week or today? Is there something in particular that you're grateful for this week?
This is going to sound very, very cheesy. And I feel sort of like a bad feminist for admitting it. But I'm this week, especially, I'm just very, very grateful to my partner. My fiance is incredible. He's a good dude. And he's come a long way.
That's great. No, that's not cheesy at all. That's great. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Caitlin. I really appreciate it. And just for everyone listening, you can follow Caitlin at Caitlin Bailey on Twitter. It is spelled Kaytlin Bailey, Bailey. And so make sure to follow Caitlin Bailey on Twitter. Follow the Oldest Profession podcast on iTunes. It's also on Spotify. You can also follow them on Twitter. And then they also have a blog on their website. It's a really great blog. And so you can basically like learn all about this if you haven't learned, if you haven't been looking into it already. And it's something that can be on your radar when you're thinking about 2020 and you're thinking about who you should vote for in the next election or who you should vote for in your local elections. What kind of laws that you should be looking out for, and who you should support in your community. So thank you so much, Caitlin. I really, really appreciate this episode. I really appreciate you coming on the show. And yeah, I hope you have a great day.
Thank you so much for having me. And I also hope that you have a great day.
Hellbent Podcast is a production of Hellbent Media. It is produced by me, Devin Handy.
And Varsha Venkata Subramanian.
And we, of course, take input from co-creator Sarah Lerner.
You can follow us on social media at Hellbent Pod on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook.
And you can join our Facebook group, Dickwads Be Gone, at facebook.com/groups/dickwadsbegone.
You can follow me on Twitter at @Varsha_Venkat.
And you can follow me at Devin Handy. Also, remember to subscribe and rate us on iTunes and rate us 5 stars because that's just the rules of feminism. Tune in every Monday and Thursday for an intersectional feminist look and the centering of women's voices and people of color. We look at current events, public policy, and upcoming elections to give you the most incisive look into stories that don't get covered elsewhere.